the mothers, the lost fathers, and the forsaken children, and let them come quickly. For a voice of crying is heard out of Zion, for we are greatly confused. For death has come into our ghettos to cut off the young men and women from the streets of Philadelphia, New York, L.A., Georgia, Ohio, Florida, Mississippi, and throughout America, South America, the Caribbean islands, Africa, Asia, and all over the world. So return unto me, thus saith Yah, and I will return unto you, O my people.
Welcome, listeners. To time for an awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. With all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforawakening.com. That's timeforanawakening.com, the homepage, and listen to the live stream there. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com. And listen to the live stream from that location also. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your carry-around devices. Your handheld devices, TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon And you can stream the program live, even into your car. That's Time for Awakening Radio Program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. That's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening Radio Program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily. And before you leave that page, do me a favor and hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening Radio Program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for Awakening Media, the homepage is there. Got some changes coming to the homepage, exciting new changes. So stay tuned for it. But just log in, and it should be one of your favorites already. It's timeforawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. There you'll see other interesting content, podcasts of the different programs that you can download, listen at later times, or even share with your friends. So again, make that one of your favorites and put it in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, we're scheduled to have a special guest join us. He'll be back for his either second or third time on Time for Awakening, lawyer and grassroots community organizer and political editor for the Atlanta Black Star. Attorney Kamal Franklin will be joining us. The discussion will center around his article that was in the Atlanta Black Star last week, "Can a Radical Black Mayor Make a Revolution?" We'll discuss the article and topics centered around that with our special guest. And hopefully he'll be joining us momentarily. But we'll be right back to get things started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072, spelled new as in numerous, on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
Thanks. I'm good, sir.
Yeah, Brother Richard, before we get started with things this evening, I want to, because I've seen that Brother Cam Howard sent me some information about the NCOBRA conference here at the UNIA building. I wasn't aware that that he was even going to be in town. What happened? Do you know about any details about what happened at the meeting?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't there. I didn't know either. I haven't been attending in meetings in the last couple of months because of personal reasons. But
okay.
No, I wasn't aware.
Yeah, I got to reach out to him because I didn't know that he was going to be in town. I want to let the listening audience know Friday's program was preempted, and I guess you enjoyed the podcast that was played. We went to one of our guests that was on about 4 months ago. Documentary film director Rel Dowdell had his screening of the documentary Where's Daddy, dealing with the ramifications of the child support system on African American men. It was held here in Philadelphia at the Kimmel Center. Interesting. A lot of folks came out. It's going to be an interesting documentary when it's finally released in February of 2018. He had a special screening for invited guests and some of the public. But it was really interesting, Richard, and I really enjoyed it. I'm a touch base.
I did also. I think it'll generate a lot of discussion. I seen the article raising the question. It's interesting they made it as far as black men under and debtor prison because of, you know, the whole thing around child support. But I think it raises a series of other important dialogue we need to have as far as about our relationships, interpersonal relationships between men and women. How do we view fathering things like that. It was also, I guess you could say, Elliot, I know everybody felt it, one of the participants in the film, the tragedy they went through based off of this type of experience.
Yeah, and I like the way he really covered it. He spanned the gamut. He had the sisters involved in the documentary as far as their experiences. And he took it from the average brother in the street to conscious hip-hop artists to people that made six figures, the doctor, some high-powered attorneys in the city. So, and they had the same experience, you know. Coincidentally, they had the same experience dealing with the child support system and affecting African American men. But it'll be interesting. We'll have him back on before it hits the public, so to speak, or before the DVD is in circulation, to kind of talk about the things, and maybe Time for Awakening can hook up and do something with him in the near future.
Definitely.
Tonight, you know, I'm glad to have Brother Kamal Franklin back on with us. You know, we had him on before to talk about some issues centering around articles that he had written for the Atlanta Black Star. And this particular article centers around something that we talk about and is near and dear to your heart, Brother Richard, is mm-hmm. the relationship between African-American politicians, the folks in the community, whether they be grassroots or just the average folk in the community, and what we need to do to move our people forward. You know, a lot of people have a little wake-up call under this Trump administration, and they're kind of in fast-forward mode about things that we need to be doing. But it's been other people that have been out here on the front, on the forefront and the front lines, doing things politically, doing things behind the scenes, doing things that our people need to know about. And our guest tonight is no exception, a lawyer, grassroots community organizer, and political and social editor for the Atlanta Black Star. Attorney Kamal Franklin is with us. Brother Franklin, how are you, sir?
I'm doing good. How are you feeling?
I'm glad to have you back with us on Time for Awakening.
Good. I'm glad to be with you guys.
Yeah. Brother Franklin, you know, I shared this article with Brother Richard as soon as it came out, and I put it on the Time for Awakening Facebook page, and I think I also put it on the website, because we talk about this subject all the time, and I wanted you to share with the listening audience your perspective on this as far as somebody that was involved on the ground in organizing, and we'll get to that later in the conversation because I think it's important. But your article, Can a Radical Black Mayor Make a Revolution, is a thought-provoking article. It kind of gives our people a perspective of things that we need to be doing politically. But before you open up your initial statements on the article, let me tell you my perspective. You know, before we started doing this program, myself, Brother Richard, and others that had been involved, I had a disdain for politics because I seen what black politicians, by and large, had failed the community. So I didn't think that that we should approach politics. We should be doing other things to kind of rally our people together to move forward. I still feel that way to a certain extent, but I understand that politics is important to what we need to do here, and while we're here, we need to channel resources, channel monies, especially in black populated areas, to things that we need to accomplish in our communities to help our people. It's an important aspect to things we need to do while we're here, and plus we need to understand how to maneuver in this system politically to get things done in regards to our neighborhoods and to our situation here. Brother Kamal, talk about the article. You say in the initial line, you start out saying the obvious answer is no. A radical black mayor cannot make a revolution. But give us a little synopsis of your article before we start going in depth.
Sure. I wanted the article to be sort of a reflection of a little bit of the time I spent in Jackson, Mississippi, with a little bit of the history of black organizing that turns to electoral politics. And I hold a similar position to yours, I think, which I try to express in the article, is that I think electoral politics plays a role, but I don't think it's the central role that our people as a whole need to think that that's going to be the solution for our problems. I think electoral politics sets the stage for some short-term solutions, some short-term answers, I should say. I think there are things that the office can accomplish, but I think unless you have an outside organizing force or community force that's directing the politics and directing the direction of those who get elected, I think elected officials will most often disappoint the community. So I think I was trying to point that out. I think we were in a period, 30, 40 years ago, where elected officials felt a little bit more connected to the Black community, particularly coming out of the Civil Rights and then Black Power era. I think we've entered a period now where few and far between Black politicians or elected officials really care or feel indebted or a strong part of the Black population. I think instead they feel like it's a jumping off point for a bigger political career. And then I think you have some outliers, people like Shokwe Sr., Shokwe Jr., Raz Baraka, maybe a couple of others, who have been dedicated to political organizing, you can say grassroots or nationalist type organizing in the community. And so at the very least, they have some pull or some thinking that makes them think about the community and hopefully move in that direction. But I still think what we miss, even with this Black Lives Matter era that we're in, I still think we're missing strong grassroots organizations that really can organize people in our actual communities. And I think that's still something that will hamper us in terms of trying to move forward.
Brother Franklin, the you mentioned earlier, you mentioned a few minutes ago about forces directing these politicians. And you talked about it in your article, how in the early 70s, when you started getting Black mayors and a lot of Black elected officials coming into these offices in majority Black cities at the time, they were kind of directed by or kind of like outreaches or for lack of a better term, maybe representatives of some type of outreach movements that came from either the Civil Rights Movement or the Black Power Movement. Some of these men early on, you mentioned in your article, that took over for mayors in certain cities, had the community at heart and the community in mind. You know, I think that we need to look at this situation in a think tank mode to see the mistakes we made and how we won't repeat these mistakes. In your opinion, how did things get off track to where Black representatives now don't look at the community for any type of moral compass, so to speak? Their moral compass is led by a white interests, a white corporate elites, other people that want to invade Black communities, take advantage of Black communities, whether it's financial or to gain land. Where did it get off track, in your opinion?
I mean, I think it got off track for a couple of reasons. One is the obvious counterinsurgents, let's say, that came into our community through COINTELPRO and larger government operations that helped destroy the organizations that we had at the time in the late 60s and early 70s. So I think we can't look at this through a sort of an analytical framework and not think about the fact that there was a counterattack that happened in our community that destroyed our movements.
Okay.
Secondly, I think our movements also, in terms of which way forward, fell back to the position of electoral politics in terms of running candidates or being involved. And I think everything from your most radical, i.e. the Panthers in Oakland, to more mainstream organizations, started to put too many eggs in that basket of electoral politics. It became a catch-all for how we were going to be free or liberated or whatever term that people would prefer to use. And I think those folks became captured interest of white economic elites, developers, big business owners, other folks who had stakes in keeping the city as it was. I live in Atlanta now, and Atlanta is probably the perfect example of a trajectory that went from someone of a Maynard Jackson type who had, again, like you were saying, ties to the civil rights and or Black Power movement, spoke to Black interest to today. But we have someone here in Atlanta, Kasim Reed, who speaks primarily about his friends and Fortune 500 companies and CEOs and how he, you know, wants to be the mayor that brings these types of groups and large scale businesses to Atlanta, and has opened the, no, I shouldn't say he opened the door, he opened the floodgates. The door was already opened by prior administrations to allowing Atlanta to be gentrified. And I think these mayors slowly became less interested in any kind of agenda for Black people and more interested in looking like they were regular mayors, or they could govern both the Black community and the white community. They wanted to think about furthering their careers past mayorships. And so I think you have the Cory Bookers, or Barack Obamas to an extent, to a large extent, and that these people represent a certain wave also of mayoral or other elected officials who think largely as our community, as just one part of their overall constituency and not the people that they serve. And then lastly, I'll say is that I think mistakenly we think too much in terms of equity and not enough in terms of power. A lot of our movements and our thinking is based on equality with other people and diversity. And those are not things that people don't hand you power. People have been fighting for diversity now for 30 or 40 years, and still most of those major organizations, those major corporations look the same. So I think we got off track because we started wanting to be included. We started looking at symbols of inclusion and stopped looking at how do we gain power in our community? How do we own resources in the very communities that we live in? So I think these things kind of took us away from the militant organizing that we had during the Black Power era and left us actually open for the type of shenanigans that we have today.
Oh, brother. I'm sorry, Elliot. Brother Franklin.
Jump in.
Hitting every chord in my being. I agree with you 10 billion percent. It's so real. The thing that you raised, though, also that's that delinking from 50 years ago, and you gave in your article an example of how this had to be negotiated, was that you mentioned earlier about the outside community organizing. The point that the so my question is, in the article you mentioned with Brother Chukwuemeka, that there was some negotiation in relationship to how to get involved in his and that senior political dynamics. One, do the outside organizers now realize that the electoral, what I'm trying to get at, did the outside organizers in the community realize that electoral politics is just a tool, which is what I got, or is it really everybody, the outside organizers and the individuals that's running, just see this as an opportunity?
I think both happens. I think you have movements that have wings, and sometimes within those movements, people believe that if you gain access to those resources that a city has, that you can direct those resources to the community. But that there's where people don't necessarily, I think, spend too much time thinking about is that there's going to be counter forces to moving those resources. And so, again, people sometimes put too much into what they can get out of that position. And then they fail to, what we fail to do is to build that outside force, or we unfortunately rely too much on a charismatic figure or a leader type figure. And that person is where the energy goes as opposed to the organizational base. And so I think that's a common mistake. I think it happens over and over again. Again, I think even in people who know that the fight is for power and not for equality, make that mistake. And I think because the electoral offices become so tempting, you believe that because you're running a city that has, let's say, 100 million to 500 million, if not more than that, that you can really move some of these resources. But normally what happens is that you wind up in those positions, you do a balancing act, i.e., I think one thing it reminds me of constantly is South Africa, right? In South Africa, you had the apartheid movement, anti-apartheid movement, which led to people being able to get apartheid taken away. But in the end, the economic system remained the same and the money stayed in the same hands. And I think that still plays out today.
And I agree. And which raises the question, and I'm just looking at, because it seemed that, well, let me ask it this way. Was Chukwe Sr. really influential in directing how the campaign for should have went? And is that based out of his particular experience with the RNA, the Republic of New Africa?
I'm sorry.
No, okay. That's
I think Chukwe played a mediating role for the wings that I spoke about within the movement, at least at the time that I was there. I think he tried to consider both what it meant to try to win that office and lead those resources, hopefully towards community development that was outside of development of large-scale real estate folks and other business operations. So I think that was something that he tried to do or wanted to do. I think the problem that we had, at least at the time I was there, was that the organization was not as strong as Chukwe was as an individual. So I think the organization still needs to. And again, this goes for any place where you're having a mayorship or leadership that's radical, is unless you have a strong outside base that can make people move, that can keep people to their promises, whether that person is radical or not, you run the risk of putting all your eggs in the basket of a mayorship as opposed to building out community organizations, grassroots organizations, militant organizations that can stand for the interest of the community.
If I'm with one more question, Elliot, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
Because I think that that's what you just mentioned is hopefully for those who are active, especially this generation, it's an important lesson that it's not asking people not to continue to do the grassroots community organizational process. Matter of fact, I agree with you that it's incumbent that they continue to work to strengthen that outside entity, regardless who's in the electoral process. And then at the same time, as you also mentioned, make sure that you understand that power is not something that people are going to hand over when you talk about the destabilizing mechanisms that came into effect for those organizations that Chukwe and others that came out of, Baraka came out of. They were gaining strength, and that's why they had the COINTEL program directed to them.
Yeah, real quickly, I was going to say that power actually adopts to black mayorships, right? They adopt to black leadership in these offices. They basically say, we can withstand this and keep our economic power, and you could be the face of the city because we know that you're going to have to come back and deal with us. And that goes for not only the economic interests, right, but the larger political interests in the states. And then for the country, these states are majority whites. Usually they're majority Republican or right leaning. And even the liberal states still know that they can withstand black mayors, even black mayors who may consider themselves to have real grassroots or radical politics because they control other levers of control. And they think they can make that person bargain to do maybe a couple of things that they may want to do, but overall they won't be able to change the larger dynamic, and that's not going to happen through mayorships.
Wow. Brother Franklin, talk about, Richard mentioned Chukwe Sr., and you were involved in forming his campaign when he won council seat, and before he passed, you was involved with him. I don't know whether you were involved with Chukwe Lumumba Jr. But
I wasn't involved in Shokri Jr.
Okay. Talk about, because you mentioned in the article, several disagreements broke out in the inner circle. And one of them was Shokri Sr.'s reluctance to become part of the electoral system because of some of the concerns that myself, Brother Richard, and other grassroots people have about becoming part of the system. But talk about some of the things that you can mention on the air, the discussions that centered around this, because I think that, you know, all of these cities where we are that's being gentrified, Atlanta's, well, you know what's going on because you shuttle from New York to Atlanta. These discussions need to be had because in these cities, we need to form some type of organizations and draft conscious people to run for these seats. It's too many people with black faces that are just black faces on white power. They represent white corporate elites and some black bourgeoisies. So we have to know how to structure these organizations, develop an organization to back different candidates, and that they'll be held responsible to the community. So talk about some of the conversations that went on. The reluctance.
I think.
Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, I think Shokri definitely had to be convinced to run for both the city council. Or initially, it was going to be him running for mayor. And again, the settled position was to run for city council. But I think he was reluctant because of his history of knowing what happens in these seats and knowing, again, that electoral politics sometimes becomes a rabbit hole. And I think it was the time period in which we were talking about this was shortly after Barack Obama's victory as president, which I think, you know, no one really predicted in terms of a black man becoming the president of the United States. So I think it became something that we thought because of the organizing and the work that had been done in Jackson for some 20, 25 odd years beforehand, that it became a logical place to direct a lot of energies and resources. In particular, Brother Kali Okuno, who helped write the Jackson Plan, or did the major writing of the Jackson Plan, who put forth the idea that we should center our resources. But Shokri didn't necessarily at first think this was going to be a great idea. But I think the more we spoke to him and said, this is something that the organization needed, this is something strategically that we could accomplish. I think he helped say, let's think about this and do this, but let's do it carefully. And I think that's why the city council race happened first. The other major part of the discussion that we were having was whether or not we would do it within a Democratic Party. And in a city like Jackson, most Democrats, in fact, in the state of Mississippi, as probably the case in most southern states, black people represent the majority of those local parties. And so the idea was that if we won within the Democratic Party, nominally on the Democratic ticket, that party was mostly black and that we could work our way out of the Democratic Party at some point. And so we kept close relations with the Freedom Democratic Party of Mississippi. The organization started with Fannie Lou Hamer. And ideally, that would become a vehicle for a political club. And I think I talk about that in the article. So, there was a lot of discussion around whether or not we build an independent party. We had other segments of our organization at the time that built an independent party in Selma, Alabama, and came close to capturing the needed amount of votes to be on to be an independent party that was always on the ballot. So there was another side of folks who were arguing that it might be more painstaking, but we might want to do that. But I think there were a couple of factors in this individual decision. One was Shokri's age, which said to us that, we probably don't have the time, if this is going to be the main person that's going to be running, to go outside of the party apparatus, particularly when it was in such an open process in terms of someone just, signing up and running. So, those discussions were things that we continually talked about and debated. I think in this latest iteration, and I just want to be clear that I left the Shokri campaign during the time of the run for the mayorship, probably 6 months before the actual election, I left the campaign. But I think that those discussions continued on, even probably upwards to his son, the first time he ran and now the second time in which he became the victor, mm-hmm. was whether or not you could really get build a power base within the Democratic Party that remained faithful, strong, and I'm going to use the term militant, in its program and beliefs for the black community, and or whether or not that stuff would get watered down because you have outside money, outside factors, other people who don't have those political positions who be in a Democratic Party pushing you away from your militant base.
You know, you mentioned the Jackson Cush Cooperative and Brother Acuna. I guess that was the rudder, so to speak, that kind of kept the candidate at the time. It was a Chokwe Sr. Right now it's Chokwe Jr. But whoever comes in, that organization would be sort of like the rudder to keep that candidate on course. And plus it would be the person, so to speak, that the candidate would have to answer to as far as the community if they failed. I think that is lacking in a lot of cities, that we don't have an organization similar to the Jackson Cush Cooperative that kind of fostered Chokwe Sr. and Jr.
Well, I just wanted for clarity. So before the Jackson Cooperative,
okay.
Well, Co-op Jackson started. That was during or after Chokwe Sr.'s election.
Okay.
The real grouping that was created was called the People's Assembly.
Okay.
And that was the group that was supposed to not be as insular as the primary organization. But this was something that anybody in the city could join, and hopefully it would be more of a mass-based place that would push politics, push progressive politics, push thought-provoking, black-centered politics from that position. And at times it was strong, and at times it lost its strength. And I think that was the place where ideally people were hoping that's where that energy would go into a formation like that.
If I may, because I think that's important mm-hmm. to kind of open up for a minute. And as you've seen for the time that you were there, and you talk about those strengths and weaknesses, what would you, to share with us your perception of the strengths of the People Assembly? Because I think that's something that we need to understand as we look for these formations in whatever city that we're in or wherever we are.
Exactly.
So what did you see? What's your perception of the strength of the formation of that of the People Assembly at the moment? And I'm going to ask for both, as you said.
I think the strengths of the People's Assembly at the time when I was there was that it allowed people outside of just the organization, the primary organization, to be a part of it and hope to cultivate those people, politically educate those people toward some of the needs, and it provided training and other things that we wanted to get accomplished that we thought we could push through that. And so I think that became a vehicle because it was open to people. People came, they became a part of it. So it became a place where people from the community, from the city could come to, and that was the strength. I think the weakness is that it got sectored off too much into committees and never developed, at least during the time I was there, into issues that it wanted to push itself. And so they became, if you had, 100 people, then there were like 20 committees. Mm. And everybody was being sort of sectionalized and working on small parts. Unfortunately, it wasn't this is during the time I was there wasn't a leading campaign that brought all these 100 people together. And so I think that became a weakness. And I think the political education that people wanted to give, although it was starting, it didn't develop in a way that brought all these folks together under common ideological positions.
If I may, the question about, 50 years ago, and when you mentioned about the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, and then it was the National Black Political Assembly, and then Republic of New Africa and the Black Power Conventions of the 60s and the 70s. Do you think that there's a national, narrative that is informing the local electoral participation today, or and is that a problem if there isn't none, as it was that 50 years ago, which Chuckwe would be a representative of?
I'm sorry. I think that narrative is not, unfortunately, is not what's leading today's young organizers. I think part of that narrative is what led Chokwe, but I think Chokwe was even led by a more powerful narrative, which was Black revolutionary thought and Black power thinking. Mm-hmm. So I think Chokwe looked at this office as a way to gain power for Black people. And I think, again, too many times, too many people who are thinking about entering this realm, or getting involved in electoral politics are thinking about equality. Mm-hmm. So they're not thinking about how they shift resources to the Black community. They want to think about how we get either the city or corporations to give more jobs to Black people. But those things are not equatable in terms of what the long-term interests of Black folks are, because as we see, sometimes these things work in cycles. And if you think about only trying to get equality, then when someone else comes in, they want to take that equality away, you have very little power to stop them because you don't control those institutions. So I think that what we need to do, in my opinion, is have these young organizers and other folks who are working on these issues really understand the concepts of Black liberation, as opposed to, unfortunately, sometimes I hear people use the term and they use it loosely, like okay. They haven't defined what liberation means. To them, it could be making sure a corporation does, hires more Black folks, or there's less racism in the police department. And those things are well and good. Those are good short-term goals. But again, if you don't control the institutions that have life and death over you, then you're no place, right? You don't have anything. You're at somebody else's whim. And you're always negotiating with somebody around the institutions that they control. So I think that's part of the problems that we have today that are sort of different than people of the era of Chokwe, who had a sense of ideological thought before they entered into these realms on mm-hmm. what it is they were trying to fight for. Mm.
Let me grab a couple of calls here. Let's go to 404 area code, 404.
Hey, good afternoon, Elliot and Richard and my brother from Atlanta Black Star. I'm right down here in the belly of the beast. I'm glad Elliot got you on there. I read all your articles, man, okay? But look here, my brother, being right here, see, in a mayorship in a city, three elements that got to be in play: business, police force, and transportation, all right? That no matter what color, whoever the color is of the mayor, but see, now we centralize on Atlanta. Okay, I don't know, y'all know, we got 13 candidates and 10 of them Black. Now, in the old days, Black people get in a room and to come out with a better candidate, instead of right now, we got these 10 people and all of them like crabs in a barrel, and they're going to end up letting the doggone these devils take back Atlanta, man. And so my question is, you, brother, is there any candidate that you particularly would like to see the next mayor? I got a pretty good idea who I know that it should be, but I want to hear what you got to say, and then I put in my input there. Who you think should be the next mayor?
I think you're right, and I think that's part of what, again, which is important for these positions, but also shows the limitations of what they can do for Black people. I think these positions are there to not only take and make sure the roads are paved, to make sure transportation works. And I think those are important things for anybody who lives in the city. But those are not revolutionary changes, right? Those are not the things that when someone has certain politics and you go into these offices, these are not the things that you immediately think you're going to be fighting for. But those are the things that you usually are directed to go for, because those are the things that people say are what's important in making a city thrive and making a city go. So I agree with you. That's what people want out of their mayorships. The problem is that we on the outside want more than that. We want people who are in those positions who are thinking about, can I take housing stock and take that housing stock and make it into some kind of land trust so that it can keep our community whole? Or can I rebuild at the all of the abandoned houses of property that the city usually owns, and basically figure out a way to get that stuff into the hands of the people who are currently there, as opposed to just selling it to developers, right? So there's a difference in terms of the radical outlook that people would like to have. Some people would like to see in these mayorships when we take these positions, that I think if you just are going into these mayorships as a regular candidate, a regular political person, then that's what you're going to be dealing with. Transportation, the roads, crime, those kind of things. And again, I'm not suggesting those things aren't important. But what I am suggesting is that those things don't make radical change.
So who, like I said, who do you think should be, in your eyes, is the best candidate to win that office?
Oh, in Atlanta, I mean, I would think Vincent Fort has the most progressive idea.
Thank you, my brother. Now you smart, my man. That's who I say too, man. Okay, Vincent Fort, for Elliot, y'all don't know, Vincent Fort be in the streets with the people, man. Okay, and I give you my own example. He helped me save my house when it was in foreclosure, man. Okay? That's how, and plus we got the same doctor, medical doctor. I talked to Mr. Ford, and I'm going to try to get him hooked up with I Am One of the Million. That's what I think I'm going to have to do. But you're right, my brother. So Atlanta Black Star, please back Mr. Vincent Ford, man. If you get in the street with the people, man. I'm telling you, Elliot, this little brother ain't no joke, man. He good, man. I don't want to take up the time, my brother. But I leave my yield my time to the people. I love your paper, love Elliot and Richard, and Vincent Ford, the man. So I want you to push it, man. All right, my brother.
Thank you for your call, sir.
Appreciate
you got it, brother. I'll be pushing him.
All right.
You know, it's interesting that brother did. You know, y'all came up with the same person, and he gave a real personal experience. But it still speaks, Brother Franklin, to the point that, you know, still you have to have that outside force that even if he becomes the mayor, that could be able to, you know, like have that people assembly. I guess that's the short way to say it. Other than that, it the pressure left on a candidate once they get inside becomes, insurmountable. Do you agree with that?
No, I definitely agree with you, because I think that's the thing that I think, you know, we want these offices, but we're not ready for them sometimes in terms of the political operation we have happening outside of these institutions. We have desires to have electoral office, but instead what we have is offices. We have people who want offices too many times and not organizations who are running people. And so, again, even if there are candidates who I respect greatly, who I'd rather, if I'm picking my, my candidates, I want them in there. But I think in general, you know, too many times folks who want to be or who should be organized in our community or organizing in our community, we haven't built the base yet. So until we build the base to have these outside formations, we should think about what it is that we want to get out of those offices only after we've done that. And I think that's part of the challenge that we have as organizers.
And if I may, before the brother mentioned about 1 million, and you had mentioned earlier about having a plank or platform, and that's one thing that could be respected about 1 million conscious and conscientious voters and contributors, that at least they formulated, you know, that plank and platform. But and it's like people like him or people like us have to be a part of organizations like that so that we can be able to curtail or execute the things that you just spoke about.
Yeah. And what we need is to have the ability to make sure that candidate, that person who wins those offices, again, feels a certain beholdenness, because there's going to be challenges. There are going to be people who are going to offer resources and money and other opportunities to these candidates, and they don't care what their radical politics are. Most people, whether or not they have radical politics or not, can fall short, you know, when faced with economic gifts, let's say.
Yeah.
And promises and the rest of it. And so there needs to be a force from outside who is saying, hey, we got you in here to do these things. And if you're not going to do these things, then we're going to expose you, or we're going to talk about you, or we're going to leave you, or we're going to say that there's a split. Unfortunately, you don't want those things to happen, but you need to have some way of not making sure that the tail is not wagging the dog.
Mm. Let's try another call. 405 area code. What's your name? Where you calling from? 405. Maybe they stepped away. We'll come back.
We got the future now.
We'll come back to them. Brother Franklin, I want to read a quote from an article that you wrote a while ago, or it might have been from an interview. And I want you to expand on this, because I think that, because you got Jackson, where you helped on Chokwe Lumumba Sr.'s campaign, but then you have other larger cities. Philadelphia is one. It kind of shuttled between the fourth and fifth largest city in this country. I think right now it's the fifth. How do we, now, I know other cities have like aldermen. Philadelphia has like a city council. I know other cities do. And then below them, you have committeemen all through the neighborhood. All of them are surrogates for the Democratic Party. Now, I want to read the statement that you made and tie it in with this question I want to ask. And it came from an interview that you had with a magazine, I think. It says, finally, the black liberal leadership class of ministers, elected officials, moneyed black elites who have greater interests in stability and status quo benefit the most from this arrangement with the Democratic Party. Most have no vision or interest in pushing a black agenda, and does more than ask for acceptance or lessening of rather than opening racial hostilities. That buffer, so to speak, between the community and resources in a lot of these cities is what you termed here the black liberal leadership class, with ministers, elected officials, and moneyed black elites. How do we push through in certain cities to build a force to buck up against, so to speak, that black elite leadership class that's a buffer between resources of these white elected officials or white communities and us getting monies channeled in our communities for various needs? How do we do that? Richard talked in private conversations that we have, talks about the need to knock on doors and build a grassroots organization. As a man that have experience building these organizations, how do you see that this can be started in cities such as Philadelphia, for example?
Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think you nailed the hit the nail on the head. It is these grassroots organizations that we have to build. And again, I think there's some possibilities now. I have some things about the Black Lives Matter movement that I like. I have some things about it I probably don't agree with. But I think we're in a time period where young people in particular are open more to being involved in politics than they were, let's say, 20 years ago when I was hitting the streets myself, and, you know, other folks who's hitting the streets who are a little older now, is that you have to be able to build on the block. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that people are open to, but I think it's also something that it's extremely hard for us to fulfill as grassroots organizers. And I really don't think it's an ideological question. I think it's an ego question. We get comfortable building small organizations at the grassroots level. We have people who want to be in charge of like 5 people and 6 people and 10 people and 15 people. But we don't know how to build an organization that's sustainable, that involves a critical mass of the people in the community. We don't know how to combine resources, and we fight each other for every penny that we can get out of these foundations for these nonprofits that we all try to build. So I think there are things that are in our way that we don't do a good job of stepping over, but we step into.
Okay.
And I think that's becoming a constant problem for us. And I think, unfortunately, too, one of the problems that I also see is that movement building is not as much right now about being in the community. Unfortunately, I'm going to say this, that it's too much about getting into media. And I know everybody wants media attention. Everybody thinks it's a good thing. But I think sometimes that is similar to winning the elected office becomes the prize. Getting a write-up in the New York Times becomes the prize, or getting covered on a radio or in a TV station becomes the prize. And that may help individuals, but that's not building movement. That's not building organization. You know, if I get written up in the New York Times, I want it to be because they're not liking me, not because they're doing necessarily a good profile.
Okay.
So I think that's part of what we have to struggle around in terms of building organization. And I apologize. My little son just woke up. And so at the same time I'm talking to you,
I understand.
I think that's one of our major things, is that we have to build grassroots organizations. We have to figure out how to overcome egos. We have to figure out how to get more than 10 people in a room. And then we have to think about what is the resources that we can claim in our community. Can we buy a community house? Can we think about cooperative grocery stores? Can we think about resources that people can collectively start to build, which is by no means an easy task, but they give us a say, a feeling of like we have some pillar of realness in this community, as opposed to just being talking heads.
Okay.
I think, you know, part of the time people don't believe in grassroots or radical thinking as much anymore, because they know that people talk, but they don't establish roots in the very communities that they talk about. Instead, they go on speaking tours. So I think we have to figure out how do we build that base. And until we do that, we're always going to be at the whims of other leaders who, again, this liberal establishment I talked about, particularly the religious establishment, they have a base in the community. They have churches. They have congregations. And they may or may not have the interest of the congregations at heart, but they certainly cannot be said that they don't have a base in those communities.
Let's grab a call. 267-267, area code, what's your name, where are you calling from?
Yes, how are you, Brother Elliot?
Great, great.
Good, good. How are you, Brother Richard?
I'm fine. How are you doing now?
Good, sir. I like your guest, sir. How are you, sir?
I'm doing really good, brother. How are you doing?
Very good, very good. So I had the experience of being with Amir Baraka while he was living. Him and I used to talk about politics a great deal. And he had a lot to do with Kenneth Gibson being elected. And as a result of Kenneth Gibson being elected, I saw that Rez ran for mayor. And unfortunately, Amir died, and he didn't get a chance to see his son elected. And I had a chance to meet Chuck Lumumba, the son. My question to you is, how are they doing, and are they successful by looking at the framework and the blueprint that their father laid down for them? I mean, I haven't followed it since Chuckley has been elected or Raz. So can you tell me the measure of success that they're doing now? Is everything working in a fashion and direction that we would see fit as grassroots people?
I mean, I'll say you brought up a good person, Amir Baraka, who I think provides an example of what grassroots organizing should look like in terms of what he did lay down in New York. He created grassroots institutions, whether they were theater institutions or community groups that people could be a part of. And I think that became something that helped Newark build. To get somebody like a Kirk Gibson at the time elected and to have these outside institutions which could challenge him. And I think that kind of, in Chokwe's case, Chokwe had a law firm. He built a grassroots organization. At various points, he represented people and helped get them out of prison, and it became community campaigns and around getting them out of prison. So I think those kind of things are the things that are needed, again, that these elders who have recently passed kind of represent a good pathway, a good example for all of us to follow again. I don't think there's anything that they did that we can't repeat. And I don't think there's anything that we need to do that's so new and different from what our elders laid down. So I think those things are important. As far as the I think, you know, Shokwe Jr. just got elected. So I think that's going to take some time to see whether or not he's going to be someone who's following his father's footsteps. I think if I read some of the articles that he said he was going to make Jackson the most radical city in America, you know, I think that's to be seen. But I think what's really important is what are the folks on the ground, people in Cooperation Jackson, what's their connection to what's happening in the city right now? What's their role with the new city administration that they helped get elected?
I like to ask
and what are they doing? Yes, sir.
Another question is does Chuck Way talk to Grass? I mean, at that point, I think the radicals should be with the radicals in order to create other radicals. Is that possible?
Well, I agree with you. I'm not privy. I couldn't answer that question. I would hope that they would. I would hope that there's combined. I definitely know that people know each other in both administrations. In fact, I would say that in both administrations, there are people who were all part of the Malcolm X grassroots movement. So I think there are definitely pathways. I'd be surprised if they didn't talk. But I couldn't answer that question directly.
Okay. Very good, sir. Thank you.
Thank you for your call.
Yes.
Brother Franklin, because I don't want to, I know that you might have your hands full, so do you still have some time to stay with us a little bit longer?
I have a few more seconds for you.
Good.
He's calm right now.
Okay. Question. We see now gentrification in a lot of these cities in the north. Are people being forced out of these communities? And usually on the face of gentrification, the face that you see out front is someone black, i.e. the things going on in the city of Philadelphia, for example. You have the city council, which is overwhelmingly black, that approved initially a $500 million grant by the city of Philadelphia for this rebuild Philadelphia. Now, they have no guarantees, no assurances of any of these companies that's going to be involved in a rebuild of hiring black people in these communities. But they gave them carte blanche as far as money to start rebuilding these recreation centers and libraries. Now, before whites start moving into these neighborhoods, black folks needed recreation centers, they needed libraries. The libraries was closed by the previous black mayor. They had limited hours. They were never open. The rec centers were in deplorable condition. For somebody that I used to play a lot of league basketball all around the city of Philadelphia. And when we visited different rec centers, you couldn't take showers in the place. You couldn't go to the bathrooms. A lot of the bathrooms was closed. They were in deplorable condition. But now, all of a sudden, when these areas are being gentrified, it's money to rehab these places. Mm-hmm. Talk about a lot of black folks that have left the cities, and some of them are going back, almost like a reverse migration, to the South. It's necessary, in my opinion, to have a political strategy when we're moving into these Southern areas again. Not just move in to be moving in and just... like you're in a tennis match, just watch stuff go on. I think that a lot of our people need to have a strategy when they're moving back to these areas. I think you're talking about that tonight. But talk about the importance of our people when they're moving into these areas, because I don't know the demographics to where a lot of our people are going. I know a lot of our people that I knew of that was in Philadelphia, for example, they were talking about going to Atlanta or going to Charlotte. But it's necessary to have a political strategy moving into these places. Talk about that from your perspective.
Mm-hmm. And again, I think that was a longer term part of the Jackson plan. I'm going to talk about Mississippi for a little while. Mississippi has the highest percentage of black people than any other state in the country. Some say it's 35, some say it's 40-41%. And Mississippi is, relatively speaking, a small state. It's probably a population of, if I remember correctly, under 5 million or approximately around that. So a few hundred thousand people moving to a
part of the country could be dramatic in terms of being the first majority black state. And so that was part of the larger term idea of Jackson, of the Jackson plan, was could we put Jackson or put this out there that black folks, when they started returning to the South, and, you know, the black Southern population always remained, even in terms of reverse migration, of 45% to 50% black in terms of the larger black population within the United States. And now with this reverse migration happening, you know, people are going places like Texas, and that's, you know, it's going to be a while before Texas is, it may turn people of color majority, but it's not going to turn black majority.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that needs to be a part of the plans that we, as larger, again, groups or people who have these ideas put forth. Are there strategic places that we should be encouraging black folks to move to? Because otherwise, whatever the power this electoral stuff could have, we diluted ourselves by not being, I guess, logical or strategic in how we suggest that people move or how we try to counter and get people to move. And so I think that always has to play a role in terms of these larger political plans around electoral power. I mean, again, mayorships don't mean a lot when you have larger state formations that can counter that power that you may gain at the city level. And until we, you have religious groups like, you know, take the Mormons in Utah, have crafted a majority because of their spiritual beliefs. And you can't do anything in Utah without their backing.
And they control it. Yeah, exactly.
They know how to win. They have political power. Because we're so divided up and we allow ourselves to be sort of conquered ideologically by other folks. We don't know how to do that for ourselves, or if we suggest that we do that, other people call us names, racist, nationalist, separatist, and we get intimidated by that. And we say, oh, no, that's not what we're talking about. So I think as long as we are unable in terms of having a critical mass to make those kind of suggestions and have black folks believe that this is truly not interest, you know, the mayorships are all we can count for and count on.
Our religious organizations, they hold a lot of power among the black community. And I'm not just talking about Christian, Muslim, Hebrew. All of these religious organizations wield power in the community. They have a captive audience on Sundays, sometimes Saturdays, during the week, Wednesdays. It's a captive audience there. Some of them outwardly say that they're reluctant to get involved in politics. But you see behind the doors, a lot of these ministers are very much involved in politics and very much involved in the Democratic Party. How do we get some of these religious organizations to understand, to move our people forward? We need to develop a political strategy that not only includes objectives and plans for our community, but ultimately to develop some type of independent party separate from the Democratic Party. I'm not even going to mention Republican, but separate from the Democratic Party. How can we convince, or how important is it to you to be able to convince our religious organizations that they need to be involved in this?
I think that's part of, again, the problem that we have, because if we as grassroots organizers are not strong or can't show strength in our community, then we can't push religious leaders to do the same. And I think there are some Christian, Islamic, right, organizations that have some voice, but they're not concentrated enough in a single organization or entity,
yes,
where they've shown that they're either their vote matters, or they've shown that their ability to bring black folks out to do different things or to build in the black community has really been at a level where it makes other people respond. And again, I think it's divide and conquer. It's our black institutions, particularly our religious institutions, are more interested in influence than they are in power. They're more interested in being seen with these elected officials than they are in making sure these elected officials know that they have to respect the power that they bring or the strategic influence that they can bring to the community. So I think that's part of what we are missing as an organization, as a people, I mean, is to build something or to have these religious institutions that can really – really have an impact. And I'm sorry. He's asking.
All right, no problem. You know what?
I'll talk about power. But,
he has power. Yes, he's showing power. Okay. Okay. I think he's showing that he has the power right now.
Right. And showing us what power is. That's what is important. Yeah.
Brother Franklin, listen, I want to thank you for being with us to share with us some insights on the article. We have some work ahead of us. Some areas of the country are further ahead in this work. You've networked with several of them. But in some of the major cities where a lot of this stuff is going on, some people haven't started. And I think that Philadelphia is a microcosm of that. I think it's a lot of work being done, but it's scattered. I think Brother Richard can attest to it. I think we need a concentrated effort, similar to what you help organize down there in Jackson. That's one of the reasons why I want to have you on, to talk about your experiences and the things that, in your estimation, needs to be accomplished in some of these cities, because we definitely need politics as a tool. And it's a tool that can be utilized. You know, you asked a question in an article that you wrote in March, and I have it in front of me in the Atlanta Black Star, and it's entitled, "Could This Be the Beginning of the End of the American Project?" These are the critical questions that need to be asked among our people, because if that's the case, like you assert, and it's another article that just came out in the Atlanta Black Star that David Love wrote, similar, and with a similar title to yours. If these things are the case, then the question, the critical question becomes, what do we do? What do we do? I mean, are we, we're not children. We're not at the whim of other people, or we shouldn't be. We need to develop ways where we can move our people forward independent of whatever happens in this country. And I think that what you talked about in this article about black radical mayors, black radical politics, and a revolution, is clear that we need a revolution among our people. And the revolution, what I'm talking about is a change of mindset. I'm not talking about somebody running and getting a weapon. The revolution it has to take place in the mind first. So I clearly appreciate your efforts and your work. I always follow your articles. Then, you know, when it just gets to me once in a while, I call you because I know you're a busy guy to come on and share with us on Time for Awakening.
Well, I mean, I thank you, and I think you're 100% correct. I think we have the makings through various organizations of something that could be bigger. And I think a lot of times, you know, some of it is ideological, but I think particularly amongst grassroots organizers, people who are in the community, I think we have to think about the bigger things that we need. And again, that it's not about having a collective of 10 people, but it's about how do we actually get more people. And if that means combining resources, if that means sharing leadership, that we need to be big enough. If that means organizing a collaborative effort in which people have their individual organizations, but we have some kind of apparatus where the leaders sit together and talk and direct resources together, we need to figure that out. Because until we grow our grassroots efforts to a sizable place where they are respected, we are not necessarily going to be able to change power dynamics. Again, we are in a place where we fight for equality, but we're not fighting for power. Equality is something that people can dish out and take back. Power is something that when you have it, people know it.
Brother Franklin, I want to thank you for being with us. I'm going to be in touch with you because there's some other things that I want to talk to you about, and I know you can help me. But I'll be in touch with you. And thanks for being with us.
And I'd love to come back on at another time. I enjoy our conversation.
Oh, certainly. The door is always open. I'll be in touch.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care now, and I appreciate the service you provide us.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate you.
All right. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, I guess we'll branch off into an open forum conversation. You can be involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Interesting conversation, Brother Richard. We'll talk about that after we come back from break. We'll be right back. Get involved. 215-490-9832 will be in open forum. Time for Awakening. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
Skin. Run, 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 but you sure can't hide. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Vote for me and I'll set you free. Rap on, brother, rap on. Well, the only person talking about love now, brother, is the preacher. And it seems nobody's interested in learning but the teacher. Segregation, determination, demonstration, integration, aggravation, humiliation, obligation to my nation. That's what the world is today.
White immigrants can come to this country 50 years ago with nickels and dimes and no education, and come here and pool their little nickels and dimes and no education and set up little stores, develop these stores into larger stores, develop this into an industry which creates job opportunities for whites. Since Lincoln was supposed to have freed the black man 100 years ago, and today the black man, according to the government economist, has spending power of $20 billion per year. We feel that with the black man spending $20 billion a year, not setting up any businesses, not creating any industry, not creating any job opportunities for his own kind, he's not in a moral position to point the finger today at the white man and tell the white man that he's discriminating against him for not giving him a job in factories that he himself set up. If the black man has $20 billion, and these so-called Negro leaders are such geniuses that they can integrate white restaurants and integrate white factories and integrate, force themselves into that which the white man has set up, they should use this same ingenuity to show the black people how to pool our wealth and set up something of our own. And then we won't have to force our way into his anymore. One more thing I would like to point out concerning what he said about 125th Street. We don't waste our time on 125th Street, but you can reach more people in the street who want to change than you can in the bourgeoisie society, the bourgeoisie church, and the bourgeoisie circles. Our program is directed toward the man in the street. So we spend our time in the street, and what we do with that man, instead of trying to change the white man in your mind, make you accept us, we change the mind of the black man and make him accept himself. And as soon as he accepts himself, he'll solve his own problem. He won't be trying to force himself into your factory and into your bedroom and into your kitchen.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And I want to thank our guest this evening, Attorney Kamal Franklin. He's the lawyer, grassroots community organizer, and political editor for the Atlanta Black Star. Interesting conversation, Brother Richard.
Yes, yes, yes. It's getting better. I hope the listening audience recognize that when you talk about think tank, when you talk about just exploring and what we have to think about, what we have to do, that the people are there to assist us in confirming or reconfirming what we think about, or even the actions that we're taking. And this platform helps us do that. It's not preaching. It's not, it's about learning, not necessarily about teaching, because everybody is participating. And if everybody can engage in this format, you know, we'll see that consolidation he was talking about can occur here to reinforce what we can do on the street as we continue to organize. It's just so important. And I have to say, I'm learning so much from this interaction. And Brother Franklin was another part of that. At least I can go to sleep at night and say, well, I'm not alone.
These things are going on. You know, we talk with the listening audience about a lot of these things, because some of our people, they get frustrated and they don't see things because they might be caught up in looking at the television or just looking at the media, and this white controlled media is not going to focus in on things going on in our community. These things are going on. These conversations are being had, and the work have been started. It's just that, you know, all of us, to a certain extent, have to become active in doing something. We all can't do the same thing, but we can all do something. And, you know, we just talked with a young lady when we were at the LOCS conference, and she mentioned that she, her reluctance to get involved in politics. And, you know, she had a grassroots mindset, grassroots perspective. But it's no different than what Brother Franklin said that Elder Chokwe Lumumba had, because of the background that he came from. He didn't want to get involved in it, but he realized, I guess through convincing the other men, that it was a tool that could be utilized. And this political, not necessarily the political system, but the apparatus of politics is a tool and can be utilized, whether we're here or whether we're on the continent or no matter where we are. The mindset is what we don't need. The mindset that have poisoned, you know, the politicians that we had. You know, Brother Franklin talked about the mindset that came out of those movements. Mm-hmm. And the early black politician that went into office, he had that movement behind him. That base was pushing him. That's why I asked him earlier. I said, what, you know, just as perspective, what changed that? Because these politicians now, they don't even want to be associated with anything black. As soon as you mention black, they're the first ones, not whites. They're the first ones to say, no. I was elected by, I represent all people. They make sure that they correct anybody that tries to associate them with anything black. So
I know what you mean.
Yeah, so, this is the thing. It's the mindset that has to change. We can utilize the tool, but we don't need that mindset. That's what's poisoning some of our brothers and sisters on the continent. This man used the same strategy that he used here with our people here. He go over there and wave money in front of people's face, wave influence, and then next thing you know, that corrupts these leaders. Next thing you know, they're abusing their own constituents, abusing their own populations in these countries. Similar to what's going on with these elected officials, abusing their own people in their communities. It's just on another level. But it's the same strategy, the same principle. The man uses the same strategy on our people. He's not changing. He don't see a need to change his game plan. He's using the same game plan over and over. And keep our people divided. That's the key part, to keep us divided. But, I like what he stated that was built in Jackson. And you see that the framework is there with Chokwe Sr. and now Jr. The framework is there. But keeping the people on track is the challenge.
Right. And that's where I understand and will agree. And it's two elements that I think that he brought up, that he constantly reiterated. The point of having that outside community organizing instrument,
mm-hmm.
and the strength that it has to have before engaging into the electoral process, utilizing the electoral machine or tool. I think that you know, we have to do more exploring about how do we strengthen how those the organizers have to strengthen the organizing effort that they do in the community. So one that he brought up, so it wouldn't be just about 5 to 10 or 15 people engage in an effort, that it does become truly a people assembly, and it can be able to be autonomous if one, so that it can, when a candidate is run, it does have those platforms and planks in place, so that candidate or candidates can be gauged by. I think that's one thing. And when you talk about the mindset, there's two things come to my mind that has to be clear. And that goes to the, he kind of said indirectly, and it's been said by others. I know that Fred Hampton Jr. had said it in the sense of political education. the need to understand what power is. You know, I think, you know, I used to adhere to Wade Noble's definition of power, and a lot of people deal with it in relationship to the social definition, to define reality and have others respond to that definition as if it was your own. But later, and I give Dr. Fox, his kudos in assisting me in expanding that definition. It goes to the point that you made in relationship to our mind, our thinking, because power has to be centered in our own self. So for me, the definition of power expanded to define reality and stick to that definition in spite of the consequences. The element about defining reality is really the powerful part. But the question of sticking to that definition is really where I see we may fall down on before the things that you raise. Because if you define the reality of you going after power in the electoral machine to do for your people, whatever that plank or platform is, but somebody sticks 50,000, 100,000, free education for your child, your chance to get a car or a trip, then whatever you define now, the circumstances then change, so that now your definition, what you define was power, you didn't stick to that. That's an interpsyche thing. That's not about the other person. That's about you. And then we have to make sure that our definition, that we're willing, even if it comes to our elimination, and that's where it gets touchy, is at question. Because when we look at men like Malcolm or Martin or Garvey or Fannie Lou Hamer or women like Fannie Lou Hamer and Ida B. Wells, when they were approached, after they defined power, they stuck to them definitions, their definition of power, of who it was supposed to serve. And in some cases, some lost their life. Mm-hmm. They didn't have to stick to it to that degree. But because they defined power and they stuck to it in spite of the circumstances, then others, we remember and honor them for that, even if we don't realize that. Mm-hmm. But each one of us has to define power in that context. And when we do, then others will respond to that definition as if it was their own. That's, I think, the interpsyche and the social definition of power we have to put into our organizations. And then the thing that Wade does say, that I also agree with, then we can create law. And then we adhere to our law, not somebody else's law. But I think those two things about the political education and about the question about being clear what power is something that he, you know, in our discussion really came up and really has to be clear before we even interact with the electoral system. Because there's a lot of influences there that, you know, it puts a lot of weight on an individual.
You know, Brother Franklin talked about our people, especially now in politics, is looking more for acceptance than power. And for the next 20 minutes or so that we have on the program this evening, because we're probably going to break a little early, we're being open for them. So you can get involved at 215-490-9832. We got a couple calls online. I'm going to get to them in a second. But to put it on another level, Richard, before I go to the calls, the desire for acceptance and not power. I'm going to use an example of this stuff going on with this NFL. Now, they let whites change the narrative as far as what Kaepernick was kneeling for. They changed it over to showing like a not a disrespect, but showing, you know, to kind of get back at Trump for his statement. So guys were just kneeling just to show obstinacy to Trump. But look at what happened. A couple of weeks ago, the league called some of the what they considered black voices among the players now to a league meeting in New York. One of the guys here from this local team went to the meeting. And they come back with, you know, because I heard the one guy that's, that went to the meeting from this team, the safety, talk in the media about, you know, the league wants to do something and they're trying to decide how they want to approach this and what they want to do. Now, that's always been our people's Achilles heel in dealing with Europeans, that Europeans want to do what's right and want to do what's morally right. You know, we don't learn from history. We don't learn from dealing with Europeans. You have to, yeah, listen, other nationalities realize dealing with this man and what he's about. They realize it clearly. But we don't want to look at it like that. We always want to give him benefit of the doubt. Now, right after they left that meeting that they had up there and thinking that owners wanted to kind of get this straight and help out community organizations, it was leaked by, I don't know who it was leaked by, maybe a member of the press or something, that no sooner than the players left that meeting, that this Houston, Texas owner said, we ain't going to have no inmates running the prison. Then all of a sudden, when it got back to these black millionaire players who don't think of themselves as inmates, when they find out that this white owner considers them an inmate the same way that you consider Pookie down the street that's in Holmesburg prison an inmate, then they get offended. I think today they was kneeling again. They don't realize that they got the power. They can say, I'm not playing. I heard one player talking about, well, they can't do anything more because against league rules. The hell with a league rule. They got the power. They can shut that crap down. Because that's all they, listen, Europeans, they love sport and they love taking advantage of people. So if you take away their sport, that's a major thing that they don't like. Then you'll really see the vitriol. They act like they love these black athletes. You really see the vitriol come out then. If they decide, well, listen, we're not playing. We ain't appearing at this game. You really see it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's no surprise that this man made a statement like that. I listened to some of these blacks that came on some of these talking head sports shows that were so shocked in the statements that was made. He's not the only one to feel that way. He's just the one that was leaked. His comments was leaked.
Mm.
So, I'm just putting it down to another level about our people looking for acceptance when they realize that they can translate it into some type of power move. Let me go, because we got a couple calls. Let me grab a couple calls here. Let's go to 646. 646.
Yes, Brother Elliot, Brother Richard. How are y'all, brothers?
Hey, sir. How you doing?
Very good.
I'm good, man. Hey, listen. Did y'all notice what happened over there in Puerto Rico with that whole thing with getting that electric grade back up to snuff and that no-bid contract that was awarded, but I guess the mayor from San Juan that your boy Trump got into it with shut it down and they had to rescind it? Now, from what I saw, they only had two employees. And the way that the owner said that they were able to gather the information and make the necessary contacts was through Lincoln. Do you believe that?
Wait a minute. Mm-hmm. Make that a little clearer. You said they only had two employees. What?
Two employees.
Well, who only had two employees?
The company that was awarded this contract only had two employees. And
wait a minute, the United States, being that that's supposed to be one of the 50 states, the government awarded this contract, right?
Yep.
Go ahead.
There was no bid, no nothing, man. What basically happened was the woman that got into it with Trump, she blew the whistle on it, and it was just too egregious to get away with, so they had to rescind it, man. You know what I mean? It couldn't pass the smell test. I mean, it had things in it where they couldn't even be audited, things of that nature. I mean, it was bananas the way that it was set up, but it couldn't happen. But in the process, because of the short period of time that they had the contract for, they made $8 million.
Ooh.
They made $8 million, I think, in maybe a week's period of time.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
But you know what, Jay, as you bring that up, you know, because lately I've, you know, been more immersed in looking at the what went on in Niger also. Isn't this the kind of thing that sets up why the people on the ground have such a disdain for America? And then America tries to put their people in place, and then they quote unquote rebel against them. Then they become the terrorists. I mean, now, hopefully, you know, those Puerto Ricans in Puerto Rico and that's in America realize that if I understand you right, I didn't see it, that Trump, like, really just Trump and that whole just slapped the whole country, you know, in the face.
Oh, he's been blatantly disrespecting them from the jump, man. I mean, the manner in which they've been treated is unbelievable. But you know what the crazy thing is? I believe that the Virgin Islands and the other islands where darker people of color have been that went through the same type of tragedies, it hasn't even been spoken about. You know what I mean? They haven't even been in the discussion, and they've catching hell just as bad and maybe even worse. But nobody's talking about it because them Negro peens in the Black Caucus, they not saying anything about it, and the Black media ain't really talking about it. All you have to do is put our people into context. If you really want to talk about Black suffering, all you have to do is say one word, Flint. That's us in a nutshell. Mm. Because Flint is no better today than it was 2 years ago.
Right.
Let's keep it real. Flint is not in a better position, and we.
No, because they still haven't changed their water supply.
No, not at all. But you'll have people. Who I ain't mad at them, but the reality is, you have people talking about, well, we need to buy property, or we should have been in a position to buy property. So when they do change the water pipes and all of that, and they get rid of the Negroes, then you know you'll be able to make some money off of it. That's the mindset of some of these Negroes.
And see, that's what I was just talking about earlier. See, we can't adopt this man's principles. And you're Jay.
But that's the principle.
I know
that's it. That's the honest principle. That's the honest principle of it. You know what I mean? But, you know, the sad thing is that we don't never connect the dots on this. We just think that, you know, Trump is so evil. It's the system. But the sad thing about it in the system, white folks get screwed just as much as we do. And if not worse, because remember, this Neanderthal said that he was going to come in and he was going to clean up the swamp. But it seems like he's doing the same type of dastardly deeds that he's talking about, being against. That's the crazy nothing, if you think about it, right?
Yeah, well, everybody, you knew that he wasn't going to clean up no swamp. He just wanted a piece of the swamp.
He
wanted a piece of the swamp. Exactly.
Now I've been listening to a couple of the the news things, because I'm kind of interested in what's going on with this whole tax thing. You know what I mean? Because I'm telling the people that I deal with, you got to start looking outward bound. You got to, you know what I mean? You got to start looking about getting the hell out of here, man, or putting yourself in the position to get out of here. Because economically, man, I think things are going to get real, real bad in this country within the next 10 to 15 years. I can't see it getting any better. It's no way it can if these tax cuts go the way that they're planning on it. It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But from what I've been hearing and what they've been saying, it seems as though there's a strong possibility that they may not let it happen because they're not going to be able to budget. They're not going to be able to balance the budget with these type of cuts. And, you know, these so-called fiscal conservatives, they ain't going to go along with that type of program from what they're saying. But, you know, you never know. But when you look at the type of tax cuts that they're saying that they're trying to do and they're looking to do, it's crazy, man. Because, you know, the thing is that always gets me in all of this is that white folks always think that the higher echelon of white folks are always going to look out for them or going to place them in a position to be able to screw the next white man, but always be able to screw the black man and any other person of color. You know what I mean? But it seems to me that that upper cracker, he's always going to screw everybody. He don't care who he got to screw. He going to screw everybody, and he'll screw his own at the drop of the hat. But he'll always give them the illusion that he's not going to screw them, that he's going to take care of them. And it seems like with this whole tax reform, the only person or the only people that's going to be taken care of is going to be that upper echelon.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely big. I heard somebody today say that, well, a question came. Well, let me say this, Jay. You made me more aware to try to focus on, because you've been raising this, on how this tax bill is going through. So I'm trying to listen. But at the same time, there's so many moving parts that don't make sense. I can't get it. But they, from what I heard, or what I'll accept is anybody below 50,000, it's not even a tax cut for them. But it's two other issues that, Elliot, it goes to what you say in relationship to us and what you're saying. Because the question that they're saying, they can't touch they don't want to touch the entitlements, right? So the question is, do America in general want to assist its poor, its suffering, and its elderly, which the Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, that's doing. And that's what they're saying. I mean, now, even Trump, politically, he don't want to touch that if he could give it, because that's his base. That's his political base. So this here tax bill, from what I'm getting, is based off of maintaining his look. But the moral question for America is, and they're saying if they don't do it, they'll never get whatever they want. So they eventually going to have to address that. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. So that's one element. That's a moral question. And America in its beginning before 1930 did not take care of anybody if you couldn't take care of yourself. The other side, and I'll close with it, is the question about in providing jobs, the technology. Because what he's saying as far as jobs, the technology, and, you know, these white people think they're going to get a job. The robots, whatever you want to call them, intelligence machines, they're the ones that's going to do, if those corporate money comes back, it's going to go into that. It's not going to go into employing people, because that's not efficient and effective for them. So they're going to deal with machines. So that question of the technology on one hand that's supposed to take care of the job issue for these
particularly whites, you know, and the question of the social safety net on the other hand, which is a moral question, is America going to take it? Those are the two questions that this tax bill brings up that we should be looking at. And that, because of what you say, Jay, you know, because we're hurt on both sides, as we already been anyway.
Yeah, but then if that's the case, then you have to morally take care of your population, because of the simple fact you would have other upheaval in the country. Because if you putting it in a situation to where as now you no longer are able to employ your people, and you no longer have anything in place to take care of your people, then how do you expect your people to be able to survive? And if you have a great deal of people and a society not being able to survive with the type of weaponry that you have in the country and the type of mindset that you have of white people, then you're going to have a hell of a insurrection on the part of white people. Let me finish because this is the key.
I agree.
It's not going to be the type of upheaval from black people, because black people just don't behave like that, because they don't respond in that way towards white people. But it's going to be a lot of white people in places like Kentucky, North Dakota, and all of these other places that is going to be affected by this. You see what I'm saying?
That's
what, you know, one has to hopefully, these senators from those states come to realize. You know what I mean? Because they're definitely looking to cause some of the most serious unevil one could ever imagine if these things go through. Because you in the situation saying, number one, there's not going to be any type of jobs and employment, you know, in the future on the scale that one would imagine. So how are people going to be able to feed themselves, clothe themselves, and live if you have now made it to whereas you've cut all of the programs necessary to just give people the basic necessities? You know what I mean? You have to have at least the basic necessities, or then you're going to have an uprising, you know what I mean, on a real serious level. And believe me, they don't want that type of uprising in this country.
But
they wouldn't be able to handle it.
Well,
because you got to remember, the world would be looking at it. You know what I mean? I would think. You know, but then but by that time, you know, another 10, 15 years, you know, I may be dead and gone. I don't know, but my family will suffer the consequences unless, you know, I can convince them and get them to understand that they must look forward. They must look homeward bound and look to be in a situation, like I always tell them, to be able to function somewhere else on the planet. You know what I mean? Because there's other places on the planet that you can go and function. You don't always have to be able to function here in America and not function someplace else. You know what I mean?
That's why,
the thing that most people don't realize.
That's why it's a key why we're here, to develop our minds to do exactly what you said, Jay. Amen.
Well,
thank you for your call.
Thank you. Have a good night, brothers. And as always, man, keep on doing what you do. Elliot and Richard, man, y'all got the best show on, you know, internet radio, man. No one do it like y'all two do it. And listen, Richard, man, you do so good on Sundays, man, to be away from the daddy on Friday, man. Talk to you later, brother.
Peace.
I ain't messing with Jay. Have a good one.
Yeah, Richard, listen, we're going to wind things down. But, you know, listen, I agree with what Jay was saying. But, you know, when Jay said that it hasn't happened before, you know, something similar has happened before with this man in his own population. Mm-hmm. That's what caused Franklin Roosevelt to come up with that New Deal.
That's it.
Because he's seen all during the 20s and the teens, 19, 10, 11, all during the 20s, he's seen where he had a population of whites, the haves, and then a huge population of whites that didn't have nothing. I'm talking about a huge population. In fact, they started targeting blacks because blacks was achieving in this society because they were segregated and they were separate. So the whites that didn't have a darn thing, all of a sudden they start targeting whites that had money. They start targeting banks, kidnapping white people's kids that had money. Then you had all types of Bonnie Clyde, Babyface Nelson, all these people. They was targeting whites that had money. And then some of the whites in the cities that didn't have nothing, they started doing all kind of old shenanigans. They talk about blacks turning these cities into shooting galleries. The whites was doing it. So when Roosevelt took office, he said, we got to do something about this. And plus they had a whole segment of white population that was totally illiterate. So they developed all types of WPA. They didn't do that for no black people. That WPA and all was for white people. And then it created, after about 10 or 15 years of enacting those policies, it created a white middle class. It didn't have no middle class in the turn of the century up until the 1920s. It was no white middle class. Either you had it or you ain't have nothing. So Jay talking about they're going to start turning on, that it has happened before.
Right. And that's the critical, I mean, that's what I guess that I just like to continue to emphasize, as you say, and you hit right where I was looking in the sense of this has been in America. This is a part of the American system. When we talk about what whites, yes, what they will do, but look what the federal government is doing. They're putting the federal military armament in the hand of local police officers. You know what I mean? So for what Jay is saying, if that occur, because them dealing with whether they're going to deal with that dilemma, as you said, Roosevelt had, and at that point, America was first because they were they were in isolation. They didn't come out of isolation until after World War II. That was the big thing of Wilson not wanting to deal with the war that was dealing with Europe, because the American public and the American political body didn't want to. It was America first. It wasn't about being getting involved with what's going on in Europe. Well, isn't that what Trump is saying? It's America first. So the question of, well, what will America do with its own population? They'll lead them in the street with holes in their shoes, soup lines as long, and this time have a military that can run through them if they think they got guns and armament for them. I mean, that's the projection, but the issue isn't about what they'll do. It's about what we're
what we going to do. Exactly. You know, during the mid-60s and all, when a lot of these cities were set on fire, you seen the military at that time or police that was militarized, not to the point that they are now, rolling all through the streets of a lot of these major cities, Detroit, right. Philadelphia, Los Angeles, Watts.
National Guard.
Yeah, you've seen them.
State apparatus.
And white America basically didn't say nothing about it.
Watched it on TV.
But what made them scream and holler is when they were having their anti-war protest, and all of a sudden, a bunch of white kids at Kent State had anti-war protests, and some of them same guns that had been pointed at black people and shooting them down shot three white kids at Kent State. Oh, that turned America on its ears. Right. In fact, that's what pushed Nixon and all to end that war. Because white folks was totally upset when they gunned down white students at Kent State.
And that's the same. It seems to be the same scenario when we talk about, well, when it was drugs, it was war on drugs for us. But now it's a national health
crisis issue. Yeah. And the people are sick. They need help. Money got to be poured in it.
Right.
I don't know whether it was money. Not the, I don't know. It was no money poured in when they put crack in these neighborhoods and watched our people, the families, be devastated with that crack epidemic. There was no money put in for that. And there's even money put in for the police to give them this Narcan. So when they see somebody overdosing on opiates, they can give them Narcan. The cops carrying around Narcan, at least in Philadelphia. I don't know about other cities.
It's that's why it is a political question for us, and that's why the discussion we have with Brother Camille Franklin about how the political machinery is not about electoral politics. It's about how do we create internal politics.
Exactly.
And utilize the electoral process
exactly.
as a tool to strengthen our internal strategic goals based off of our development of our internal politics.
Yeah.
And that's,
and I think that's
at one point it may not be there, and we still have to govern ourselves. And in that, the question is, what is our moral foundation for the politics that we put in place? Are we going to look for our sick and our elderly, our young, or are we going to, like America do, say, well, you it's the American way, you get it, the best way you can.
And, that's the argument that I think a lot of our people have. And then, listen, I'll admit that's the argument that I was missing, which you just stated. Because I was always looking at the picture of getting involved in politics, and then you'll end up being part of the problem and not part of the solution. But it's getting involved in politics and using it as a tool. Take his mindset out of it. Leave that part and use the other part. Because there's other parts involved in that process that is useful tools. But that mindset we don't need. And that's where cultural values come into play, Richard. And you know it better than me.
There you go.
Cultural values come into play then. You have to know your culture, know who you are, and know your cultural values. Other than that, you'll be mimicking Europeans and become a Negropean, as Jay says. Mm-hmm. We got too many of them, and one is enough. We don't need any more.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, before we leave this evening, I just want to let the listening audience know to tune in. And I know you've been tuning in the past 3 weeks that he's been on. Monday at 11 o'clock, you have African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. It'll be on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 to 1. This show is growing in popularity. Tune in to African Perspectives Monday from 11 to 1 with Brother Oshi on Wednesday. From 8 to 10, Sister POC, she's the old veteran on Time for Awakening now. Sister POC with Revive will be on Wednesday from 8 to 10. On Thursday, ULU, Black Economic Cooperative, will be on. Their program is 9 to 11 on Thursday evenings. Thursday evenings, catch ULU's program 9 to 11 on Thursday. Friday, we'll be right back with Time for Awakening on at 8 p.m. on Friday evenings, 8 to 10, and then Saturday with SST, Saturday Sports Talk with Troy Wilmore at 10 o'clock to 12, and in the afternoon, 4 to 6, with Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers, and then we start all over again on Sunday with Revive and Sister POC, 11 to 1 on Sunday mornings. More programs going to start in November, and a revamping of the Time for Awakening website. It'll be more user-friendly. I think it's more user-friendly now, but we'll have more programs on the site where you can download and listen to their podcast. So it's going to be some changes to the website coming in November, along with some new programs. Listen, this wouldn't be possible if it wasn't for you guys out there listening. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school,